The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way. And that's with Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts and help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's designed by real people for real conversations, and their tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/bluewire. That's 60% off at babbel.com/bluewire, spelled BABBEL.com/bluewire. Rules and restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Red Leg Roundtable. For this episode, I am joined by the Riverfront's Nate Dodson, because we got a hold of a book recently, and we really enjoyed it, and we plowed right through it in separate states. We weren't reading it together, but Nate and I are joined by New York Times bestselling author Keith O'Brien. Keith, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. Pleasure to be here.
Well, the book is Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose, and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Yeah, absolutely. I went and got one at the library today, Keith. I have the Kindle version, but I wanted to have the physical version to hold up here. Just a great book. And before we get rolling with some questions, I want to commend you, because the beginning of the book is so well written, and it encapsulates the way so many of us Reds fans and probably Cincinnatians feel about Pete Rose, and how conflicted it is to have the feelings we do about the baseball player Pete Rose and then the off-field Pete Rose. I thought you did such a masterful job of getting that started.
Oh, thank you so much for that, Seth. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, you know, you guys know, because you've read the book, you know, I approach this book like I have all my other books. You know, this is, you know, I'm not in the book. It's not about me. There's no I, there's no me in it. This is a reported, you know, narrative nonfiction. But, you know, I grew up in Cincinnati in the 1970s and 80s, and I used those feelings that I remember, you know, from the 80s in particular, to inform, you know, my reporting and my writing. So that, thank you for that, Seth. That means a lot to me.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I was born in 1979, so I didn't see Big Red Machine. I don't remember the hit, right? The 4192 hit. So for me, it's just always been what my grandfather said and what other people said about Pete Rose.
Yeah, so, you know, I'll date myself here. So I was born in 73. So I'm too young also to remember the Big Red Machine years. I sort of grew up on the stories of those teams, like we all did in the early 80s. But I remember, you know, certainly when Pete Rose was traded back to the Reds in 1984, I remember exactly where I was standing, in September 1985, when Pete set the all-time hit record. And I remember all the feelings that baseball fans and Cincinnatians felt in 1989, you know, when the scandal broke and devoured that entire season. So, you know, again, and I tried to use those feelings and emotions that I remember to inform my reporting, to inform my writing, and try to tell the story in a powerful and compelling way.
Nate?
Yeah, I think that really showed through. You know, I guess you guys have a couple years on me, not too many, but my first real memories of the Reds are the 1990 World Series team. You know, I was 5 years old that season, and I say real memories, but even those are pretty vague. It really struck me throughout reading this book that all of this, all of the the buildup, I guess you can call it the climax. I don't know if you want to call it that or not, but the end of the saga sort of happened right when I was becoming a baseball fan. So you hear about the Big Red Machine, the legend of Pete Rose. I'm raised to believe he should be in the Hall of Fame, not understanding that this happened moments before my fanhood really began. And the way that you told the story in such a narrative way without necessarily trying to lead someone to one direction or the other, you know, people are allowed to come to their own conclusions, I thought was a really fantastic way to approach this.
Well, right. And that's another thing I wanted to do. You know, again, you've read the book, so you know I'm not here to make an argument for Pete Rose. I'm not here to make an argument against Pete Rose. I wanted to look at his story through the prism of history, tell that story with granular reporting, interviews with the people who were there, you know, federal court records, the entire voluminous 1989 Major League Baseball investigation. You know, use all of those things to tell the story and then let people come to their own conclusion. I think all too often when people write about Pete Rose, they are choosing words that inform the reader what their opinions are about Pete Rose. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to do was, you know, just tell the story and let people come to their own conclusions. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's something I learned long ago as a journalist, you know, don't tell people how to feel, show them the story, let them feel how they will.
Well, you've already mentioned you grew up in Cincinnati, you had time in the city. That probably drew you to want to tell this story, I assume. But what kind of background, already knowledge, did you use going into writing this book?
Well, yeah. So I'm a Cincinnatian by birth, born and raised, and I'm a baseball fan. So like a lot of Cincinnatians and like most baseball fans, I knew the broad strokes of the Pete Rose story. I also felt that, you know, a lot of the stuff that's been written about him before failed to capture the human drama. And that's what this is. You know, this is a human story. And when you think about Pete Rose as a human, instead of thinking about him as a baseball player, I think it just gets a lot more interesting. You know, this was a kid of from an ordinary background on the west side of Cincinnati, or ordinary working class background. He was a kid of ordinary talents, of ordinary athleticism. He's never the best player on his own youth baseball teams on the west side. He's never the best player on his high school baseball teams at Western Hills. You know, by rights, he probably shouldn't make the minor leagues or the major leagues. I think today it maybe doesn't happen. But when it does happen for Pete Rose in the early 1960s, you know, he makes the most of every opportunity. He scrapes and claws his way to the mountaintop. He gets there, of course, and then he loses it all through his own choices, his own decisions, his own addictions. That is a compelling human story. I think it's one of the most fascinating athletic stories of any athlete in the past 100 years. And so, you know, yeah, as a Cincinnatian and as a baseball fan, I knew a lot of those, the big picture of the story, but I too had failed to know some of those things, including the fact that he was never the best player on his own youth baseball teams. You know, I didn't know that. And there were many other things that I didn't know about Pete Rose and this story until I got into it.
Nate?
Yeah. You know, when your subject is arguably the most interesting baseball player of all time, I guess you have so many directions and so many rows that you can take. But did you have any preconceived notions that you sort of had to set aside to tell an unbiased story?
That's a great question. You know, I've been a journalist now for, you know, almost three decades. So, you know, I have long ago set aside any biases or allegiances, you know, as I approach a subject. But yeah, I mean, this is different, certainly. I will say of all the books I've written, this is the most personal book, even though, again, I'm not in it. It's not about me. There's no me in the book. You know, I'm from Cincinnati. And so in a lot of ways, you know, when I'm writing about the West Side or I'm writing about, you know, the Moeller West High game in the late 1950s, the Pete Rose plays in. You know, I know those places. It is, you know, closer to me, I would say. And of course, you know, in my reporting, I did get access to Pete Rose, which is in and of itself a rare thing. Pete has never before spoken to an author for a book unless he had editorial control over that book. And I want to be clear, he did not have editorial control here, but I did get access to him. And I did do 27 hours of recorded interviews with Pete Rose, both on the phone at first and then in person with Pete in Las Vegas, where he lives. And in addition to that, I spent a couple days out on the road with Pete at, you know, these signing shows that he goes to, these appearances that he makes these days. And so I did have this access. And, you know, I'll be honest, there were, you know, a couple of moments where, you know, I slipped into the skin of my 12-year-old self and was like, you know, I'm sitting here asking Pete Rose questions, you know, about his gambling, or I'm sitting here asking Pete Rose questions about the night that he broke the all-time hit record. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I'm a journalist, I'm a historian, and, you know, I was pushing Pete. You know, as you know, and as your viewers and listeners will know, as any Cincinnati Reds fan knows, Pete has written his own memoirs about his life. He's written no fewer than a half dozen of them going back to 1970. And, you know, the memoirs are pretty thin on details. Even the one in 2004 where he finally admits that he's been lying all these years and indeed he has bet on baseball. Even that memoir is very superficial on details. And so, you know, my job was to push Pete, you know, beyond what he had told us before. And really, in a lot of instances, at times I was asking the easiest of questions, like, why? You know, why didn't you tell the truth here? Or why didn't you tell the truth there? What was stopping you from doing that? And I think, you know, I give Pete credit. You know, he did talk to me about things. He did say things to me that he's never said before or talked about before. But ultimately, I do think I pushed Pete as far as he was willing to go, because he did ultimately stop calling me back. He shut down, and I haven't heard from him for some time, even since the book has come out here.
I guess on that end, how satisfied were you with how far you got him to go? Were you at points where you weren't as happy as what you hoped you could get? And of course, you probably knew going in, I might not get what I want.
Sure. Well, I mean, for starters, again, I felt incredibly grateful that I had access at all. Mm-hmm. Because again, you know, he's never spoken to someone like me before working on a project that he didn't have control over. So I was grateful for any access. Once I did get the access, of course, yeah, now I want to know everything I can know. And again, you know, as I said, Pete did reveal things and talk about things with me that he hadn't talked about before. He talked about, you know, the inception of his gambling, where it started, what it felt like. He talked about, you know, how it deepened. You know, he talked about the lies and why he lied, you know. In February 1989, 35 years ago, a rumor reaches the offices of Major League Baseball that Sports Illustrated is investigating a tip that Pete Rose has bet on baseball. And at that point, it's just a rumor, and that's all it is. And Major League Baseball calls him to New York for a meeting, a secret meeting. Now, the press doesn't know, might not have made headlines at all. And in that meeting, they ask him point blank, is what Sports Illustrated digging into, is that true? And Pete lies that day. And then he lies again later that spring, and just 2 months later, when now it's not a rumor anymore. The press is circling. They've published many stories about what they think is happening, stories that, in by and large, are true. And now Major League Baseball has a dossier of information on him that they didn't have 2 months earlier. And there's a 2-day deposition, a secret deposition again, in a basement of a Catholic school in Dayton. And, you know, at this meeting, it's the opposite of the February one. Baseball has everything. And, and I, you know, I interviewed John Dowd, the special counsel that had been hired by Major League Baseball to investigate Pete. And Dowd told me that Bart Giamatti, the commissioner of baseball, had informed Dowd not to play gotcha with Pete Rose, but to go into that deposition and lay everything out, show him exactly what we have, with the idea being Pete Rose would see the preponderance of the evidence and finally, you know, admit to what he had done. But Pete Rose tells me that he goes into that meeting with a completely different mindset. And it's a very Pete Rosean mindset. And his mindset going into that deposition is give Dowd nothing. He's fighting for his life at that point. He's fighting for his livelihood. And he makes that decision. And again, that's something he hadn't talked about before. And I think it is, you know, informative to hear that. Because I do think it's very Pete Rose. And I think it gets to the heart of his character, you know. And it helped me sort of understand him a little bit more. If, not forgive him, but understand him. And by that I mean, you know, I finally identified that Pete Rose succeeded as a player and failed as a person for the very same reasons, for the very same qualities. You know, he succeeds as a player for all the reasons we know as baseball fans. You know, he plays with fury. He will not be vulnerable. He will not bend. He will get in a fight with you at second base to break up a double play. And he believes in his heart at all times that he's going to beat you. He's going to prevail. He's an eternal optimist. And that's a really powerful quality to have as a hitter. But those same qualities, his refusal to be vulnerable, his refusal to bend, his inability to see that he can't fight his way out of this one, are what is ultimately going to bring him down in the end. So all of that was helpful. But back to your question, yeah, did Pete tell me everything? No,
no.
He did. And when I asked him about that meeting, that secret meeting in February 1989, he told me that he couldn't remember it. And I find that very hard to believe. This is a man who, even in his early 80s, can tell you pitch sequences from an at-bat 45, 50 years ago. This is a man who can tell you exactly how many doubles he hit for the Macon Peaches in 1962. You're telling me he doesn't remember a meeting where his whole life is on the line? I find that hard to believe.
Well, and that's later on in this interview. I'd like to talk to you about some of those Pete contradictions, which they're full of. Nate, did you have another one?
One quick question was that, you know, I want to let our audience know that this book is not just entirely about sort of Pete Rose's fall from grace. There is some fantastic just bits and pieces from everything from when he was a small child and going into boxing matches and swimming pools up through his career, things that the Reds fan, the positive Reds fan in you is really going to appreciate by reading this book. Obviously, when it gets down to interviews like these, I imagine people like talking about some of the juicier bits. But I was very intrigued by how Pete was always this extremely cocky, confident person. That was just always who he was. And it shone through in every page of the book until sort of the end, like when he knew he couldn't win. And I was curious if in your face-to-faces with him, if that sort of came through, or was he back to being that confident guy that I guess Reds fans are so used to hearing about?
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You know, when you spend as much time with Pete Rose as I was fortunate enough to do, you sort of experience all the seasons of the year. You know, you get the arrogance, or the cockiness, you get the crass, comments, you get the storytelling, which, you know, usually reflects, you know, well on him. But you also get the charisma, and you really get all of that. And it's interesting, you know. Again, I mentioned I felt fortunate to get access to Rose because I could learn things about him that we didn't know before. And that could help us understand what happened here. Because I do think 35 years later, as baseball fans, we're still sorting through the wreckage of the Pete Rose story and trying to understand what the heck happened. you know, but being with him in person helped me understand that charisma too. And he does have a charisma. He has a thing that, you know, the most famous politicians have, the most popular stars have. He's just got that sort of energy about him that you feel when you're with him. And I saw it happen many times with total strangers who would drift by his table or come to his signing table and would be honestly, emotional with him, crying at times, trying to talk, get out a few words to Pete Rose. And again, I've, you know, been a journalist for three decades. I've, you know, covered lots of big events and important people. I have never seen an ordinary person break down and cry at the sight of another person, a famous person. I've never seen that before. And I mentioned that because, you know, in my interviews that I did with others, and I want to be clear, and you're right, Nate, this is far more than just a book built on Pete Rose interviews, and it's far more than just a book about Pete Rose's downfall. It is the whole story. It's the rise and fall. It's everything. And I did, you know, almost 200 hours of interviews with other people. And some of those people had once been very close to Pete, his closest friends, his first wife, guys from his inner circle who placed his bets on baseball. But now they were no longer in that inner circle. They were no longer in his good graces. They were no longer married to him. And, you know, at times in those interviews, those folks, you know, broke down and cried, not recalling some particularly emotional moment, but just like, a story, a night, a scene that with Pete Rose. And, you know, I don't think I would have understood why they felt so strongly if I hadn't also had access to Pete and felt even just a fraction of what they had once felt when they were in his inner circle.
Hey, so one of the big things with Pete is he came up and I actually got to interview Hal McCoy, the Dayton Daily News sports writer, a few months ago. And he talked about how when he came onto the beat in 1974, all the players, himself, Marty Brenneman, they were all just friends. And a lot of times, even before him, was Scoot Slauson, the sports writer you mentioned many times in the book. These folks, and it happened with Babe Ruth, it happened with all the Ty Cobb, it happened with all these people. That era was, we don't report on those things. We report on baseball, and we tell the story of how exciting it is and how great he is and all these things. And I think he kind of came across a situation where sometime it just changed, right? And maybe today people, maybe athletes today are more guarded on purpose, right? Because they know they're on that spotlight. But Pete got caught in the middle of those two eras, didn't he?
Right. I mean, Pete Rose's professional baseball career spans 30 seasons. I mean, think about that for a second. You know, he's a rookie minor leaguer in June 1960, and he's banned from baseball as a manager in August 1989. 30 seasons.
Spoiler alert.
And what's that?
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, as if nobody knew. Yeah, right. Yeah, spoiler alert. Yeah. You know, and I mean, in that time, everything changes. Everything. The whole world changes. But, you know, I think Pete doesn't change. At the end, he's just got more money. He's got more power. He's got more fame. But at the baseline, he's the same person he was in the 1960s. And yeah, you're right, Seth. You know, in the 60s in particular, reporters, beat writers had incredible access to the players. And I think also important is there wasn't such a divide in their finances as there is today. Mm-hmm. You know, a reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer was obviously not making, Willie Mays money in 1963, but he was making Pete Rose money in 1963. And so, you know, there wasn't that strata between a beat writer and a player. And because they had that intimate access with coming and going in and out of the locker room, they did become friends with them. They traveled with them on the plane. They stayed with them at the team hotel. They often went out carousing with them at night. And so, yeah, they protected them. And, you know, by the late 1980s, that has certainly changed. The players are now making millions of dollars. Reporters are making $45,000 a year if they're lucky. And, you know, they are also living in a different media landscape, you know, a 24/7 landscape, ESPN, CNN, Sports Illustrated's got an entire investigative team of reporters. All they do is investigate stories. So yeah, the world changes. Pete Rose doesn't change, but I think you hit on something that's important. You know, you mentioned, you know, that players are more guarded today. I don't think it's just that they're more guarded in what they say, although they are. It's that they're more protected. You know, reporters don't have near the access today to athletes as they once did, even just a decade ago, especially going back 40 years. Forget about it. You know, oftentimes, you know, there are limits on how long or when you can be in the clubhouse. And many times the interviews that are happening with an athlete are happening at a table, at a press conference, in a room with 40 or 50 other reporters. And you got like 7 minutes and maybe you get in one question, maybe. So it's just a completely different landscape. But, you know, I want to get back something you said, Nate, because you're right. You know, I think even Reds fans have forgotten why we cared about Pete Rose in the first place. You know, the last 35 years, while he's become sort of a caricature of his former self, we forgot why we ever cared. And so one thing I wanted to do with the book was go back and tell that story. You know, as you said, from those modest roots on the West Side, you know, all the way up, you know, to the 1980s. And when you look at Pete Rose's story that way, you realize you simply cannot tell the story of baseball in the 20th century without him. He is in the middle of so many important games, moments, and stories. You can't tell the story of baseball without him.
Hey, I wanted to address the chapter where you dealt with Ray Fosse in the 1970 All-Star Game at Riverfront Stadium. And I think it's why it gives us a glimpse into the polarizing aspect of Pete as a player. He ran over Ray Fosse in a meaningless, to us today, right, All-Star game, an exhibition. But this was a time when the National League hated the American League. This was a time when Pete was always going to be aggressive, no matter the circumstance. And he took out Ray Fosse at home plate. You dove into extensively the ways that that's looked at differently today, post 2002, when the All-Star game ended in a tie. I loved how you highlighted that. I guess to me, that might be a microcosm though, of what we're talking about here. Like how we look at people, how we look at athletes has changed, and Pete hasn't, as you've said.
Yeah. So, you know, anytime there was a significant moment, the Fosse collision, the 1973 fight with Bud Harrelson during the NLCS, obviously the World Series, the hit streak, you know, the gambling investigation. Anytime there's a crucial moment, I wanted to do a lot of reporting around that. And the Fosse collision in the All-Star game in July 1970 was absolutely one of these moments. I feel like that collision it changes both men's lives forever, one for the good and one for the ill. And, you know, even in the moment, in the moments after that play, when both teams go to their respective clubhouses, there was debate about whether Rose should have done that. You know, that night, some players thought it was too much. It was unacceptable to hit a guy like that in an All-Star game. I think also notable is that a lot of future Hall of Famers that night said that was 100% the right play. Earl Weaver, the manager of the Orioles, who's managing the American League team that night, thought it was the right thing to do. Hall of Famer. Gil Hodges, the manager of the National League team that night, the manager of the Mets, thought it was the right thing to do. And notably, Leo DeRocher, the manager of the Cubs, future Hall of Famer, is waving Rose down the line. You know, anyone who is interested in baseball or interested in the Reds and doesn't know this story, I urge you, go on YouTube and find what you can find, because there's a lot of good clips, even just on YouTube. And when you go there, you see that DeRocher isn't just sending him home. He's running down the line with him. He is shouting at him and waving his arms. And even as the collision happens, DeRocher is like only 30 feet away at that point. He's like halfway down the baseline. And so, you know, people in the moment think it's, you know, was the right play. And over time, that shifts. And this happens a lot when people live long enough. You know, when people live long enough, the principles are in a moment, they can go back and revisit what happened and think of it differently. And certainly that happens with Ray Fosse to a certain extent. But more importantly, it happens with baseball fans, you know. And as you said, Seth, by 2002, you know, when we're letting All-Star games end in a tie because managers have emptied their benches just to give everybody a chance to play instead of trying to win the game, you know, we now struggle to understand why anybody would have hurt another person in a midseason exhibition game. And so this moment becomes like a character flaw in the minds of some people for Pete Rose. You know, something must be wrong with him if he's willing to play that hard in an exhibition game. And to be fair, there were people who thought that very night in July 1970, but there were a lot of people who didn't.
Yeah, that's great. I wanted to touch on a few things that aren't necessarily specifically Pete Rose related. So, Seth, if you have some more questions that pertain to Pete, please, by all means, ask away. But if not, let me go ahead and jump in here. So, by the end of the book, Keith, the latter part of the title really, really stuck out to me. It's the last glory days of baseball. And being a little, you know, being almost 40 now, I didn't get to experience it firsthand, but it was everything I ever heard, everything I ever read, and it really shines through in the book. You mentioned 40 million viewers to Game 7 of the 1975 World Series. The 2023 World Series topped that at 6 million viewers. You know, what are some of the key contributors to this, in your opinion? And did you always intend for that portion for that to be part of the title, or did that sort of happen?
Yeah, great question. You know, the title of the book itself, Charlie Hustle, that was the title when I conceived it. That was the title when I sold it on proposal. The subtitle, you know, probably changed a dozen times. And, you know, what I was trying to capture, not just with the subtitle, but with the subtext of the book, is that, you know, Rose is there in this time in baseball where things do change. And, you know, I want to be clear. I'm a baseball fan now. I love baseball. I watch the important games. I follow the stats, and certainly I'm watching every October. But unquestionably, baseball doesn't carve out the slice of American consciousness in 2024 as it did in 1984 or 1974. Or 1964. And there's a ton of reasons for that. Some of them are cultural, driven by, you know, a changing media. You know, a lot of baseball fans, younger ones, might not watch the game on cable TV or network TV. They're devouring it, you know, on TikTok and YouTube, or the videos, you know, highlights the next morning. So we're still caring. We're just not doing it in the way that, you know, we might have done it in the 90s or the 80s. But some changes are part of how the game has changed. You know, in the 1960s and 70s, there was an annual poll that was done that asked fans, what was your favorite sport? And all the way through the 60s, baseball is always number one. You know, Americans choose baseball first. But after the Joe Namath Super Bowl, the Jets defeating the Colts in Super Bowl III, everything starts to change. And for the very first time, Americans say that football is their favorite sport. And every year after that, it's moving in the same direction. More people are choosing football. Fewer people are choosing baseball. And you know, I think part of that is just, you know, a shift with the times. But baseball does itself no favors, especially into the 1990s. I think it's notable that in the summer of 1989, when Major League Baseball was pulling out all the stops to investigate Pete Rose, as they should have done, players are already injecting themselves with steroids, at least in Oakland, California, and possibly elsewhere. And we all know what's going to happen over the course of the 1990s and into the 2000s. You know, steroids is going to change the game. It's going to gut the statistics. It's going to turn off a lot of fans. After it brings a lot of fans to the game, it's going to turn a lot of fans off. And I think you can trace, you know, even the rule changes that Major League Baseball instituted last year to all of that. You know, the slowness of the game, the launch angle, the strikeouts, the declining batting average, all of that can be drawn with a straight line, I think, to the steroid era. And so, you know, I do think that the game has changed. And, you know, I think we've even seen it in recent weeks. You know, when Pete Rose, you know, was even rumored to be gambling or ensnared in a gambling scandal, it was a massive national story. And again, it devours the entire 1989 season. I think the average sports fan probably has already forgotten that Shohei Ohtani and his interpreter were ensnared in a major gambling scandal, you know, just a few weeks ago. And, you know, I think that most fans probably can't even name the interpreter himself at this point. We've already moved on.
Well, Ipe, right? Ipe.
Jimmy Zuhara, yes.
Hey, we'll open it up if we have anything else, but I want to go down through some of these notes I took on what I perceive to be kind of contradictions and why people could be on either side of Pete, right? You already mentioned the contradictory nature started early. He wasn't even really a prospect, and yet he gets into the good graces of somebody because of an uncle, and he gets to go play. And go ahead, since you've already talked about that one, but I'll go through these and maybe rapid fire. if you have a thought or something like that. His nickname, Charlie Hustle, was not meant to be a compliment, yet he loved it, right?
Yes, that was a great part of the book. I love that.
Thank you. Yeah. Pete rebrands it. He does something he's still doing today. He rebrands the moment. He would never use the word rebrand, but that's what he does. He's particularly good at that. He's good at rebranding things.
Yeah. Okay. And then he's a singles hitter. Even back then, the country, the baseball fans, they loved the power hitter, right? And yet this singles hitter became, probably as of midsummer 1970, just the talk of the country. And he became a star. A singles hitter became a star.
And he's obsessed with the idea that he's going to be the first $100,000 singles hitter. He's going to reach that milestone. And I think it's interesting, you know, Nate, you mentioned his arrogance earlier, his cockiness. That even comes through in his, you know, in his contract negotiations at a time when players never talked to the press about what they were making or what they wanted to make. You know, Pete Rose was out there politicking in the sports press, telling everybody he was underpaid. He was underpaid and he should be making $100,000.
We mentioned the Fosse collision, but it both elevated and villainized him. We'll move on from there. The Johnny Bench Pete Rose thing, a lot of times Johnny was even a little more respected at times, cheered for more than Pete. But boy, Pete's love of baseball was a big trump card, wasn't it? He just loved the game.
Yeah, you know, the Pete and Johnny friendship is a fascinating one. I think even now in Cincinnati, it's a dividing line. There are those who are with Johnny and there are those who are with Pete. And that was certainly the case in the 1970s. It's a fascinating, thing to examine because, you know, on the face of it, Pete Rose, you know, is a native Cincinnatian, born and raised on the West Side. You know, he has all those Cincinnati values about working hard and hustling and grit and tenacity. Those are Cincinnati qualities. Those are things that we think of when we think of ourselves. But, you know, in the late 1960s, you know, Johnny Bench, you know, gets called up to the Reds. He becomes an instant star. Rookie of the year, a rookie all-star. And by 1970, Johnny Bench, who's several years younger than Pete, is already one of the most famous baseball players in the country. And he's like the opposite of Pete in so many ways. He's younger than him. He's taller than him. He's better looking than him. He's better spoken than him. He's single. You know, Pete chooses to live on the West Side. Johnny gets this, you know, beautiful bachelor pad in Mount Adams. Everything about the two men are different. And yet in some ways, Johnny is more Cincinnati than Pete, you know, because another thing that Cincinnatians are, again, if we're just going to talk in general terms, is, you know, they're sort of buttoned up. Conservative, not politically, I mean, just conservative Midwesterners going to say and do the right thing. And what does Johnny Bench do? He always says and does the right thing. And here's Pete Rose saying and doing whatever he wants. And so, yeah, there's a dividing line in Cincinnati on these two men. And I think there still is today.
It reminds me a little bit of Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods, because there's people that loved Phil and there's people that loved Tiger. And then Tiger had his issues back in 2009, and my mother-in-law was one of them. She's like, you see, he's just such a bad person. I love Phil. And I'm like, well, okay. But then Phil ends up with the gambling stuff himself and some other things with some things maybe he was taking, and he went to live golf. And so it's just the two kind of remind me of each other a little bit.
That's very interesting comparison. I like that, Seth. I like that, Seth.
All right, so we've talked about him being cocky, maybe even selfish, right? But he moves positions multiple times. That's a contradiction. He moves positions after he's already won a National League MVP to make the team better.
He moves back to the infield. Mm-hmm. He goes, You know, he goes from the outfield to playing third base in the early in the 1975 season when the Reds are struggling. And Sparky Anderson, the manager, is looking for a way to get Ken Griffey and George Foster in the lineup every day. You know, and so he goes to Rose and asks if he'll play third. And, you know, Rose says in the media that week, I don't even own an athletic cup anymore. You know, yep. He hasn't played infield in like a decade. And the last time he played third was 1964, and it went really badly. And he was quickly moved, you know, to the outfield. And they had moved him in 64 to make room, you know, for another second baseman. So, you know, the fact that he goes to third base is unselfish, even though Pete himself is often selfish. And, you know, when they win the World Series that year, again, Nate, spoiler alert, when they win the World Series in 1975, in the champagne-soaked locker room at Fenway Park, one of the first things that General Manager Bob Housem says is that we got here because Pete was willing to move to third base, which put our best team on the field every single day. It was important.
Absolutely, it was. One of the points you made, actually, talking about that, you mentioned in the book, it stuck out to me big time when you talked about him moving positions. You mentioned that he was thinking kind of like a manager, and he saw that Sparky had a point. Is that one of those things Pete confided in you when you were able to talk to him, or did you read that somewhere else, or where did you get that?
Yeah, no, Pete did talk about that, and, you know, interestingly, you know, as we all know, Pete Rose will become a player manager in 1984. But as early as like 1975, 76, there are already quotes in the papers that Pete wants to manage. Mm-hmm. You know, that's his future. That's what he wants to do. And so he is starting to think, you know, like a manager, even in 1975.
Okay. Nate, did you have any other questions?
I've got a few sort of more general ones, not necessarily specifically about this book. So if you have any more directly related to the book, please go ahead, Seth.
Well, the last thing I'd say is you had Cincinnati police officer Chuck Zimmerman. You mentioned him and how he had seen Pete at the track a lot. The words you used were, he didn't want to know what he didn't know. He didn't want to know what he didn't know about Pete Rose. He knew something was there. And I feel like that speaks to an entire Cincinnati area, Ohio, maybe even baseball fans around the world and the country. It felt like, I mean, how many people maybe went to their grave never knowing how bad a guy Ty Cobb was, right? And so they go to their grave as Detroit Tiger fans thinking that Ty Cobb was just this awesome baseball player. We've learned a lot about Ty Cobb since then, right? In some ways, it would just be so much easier if we only knew him as the baseball player.
Well, it would be a lot easier. And I think, you know, again, one thing that my reporting shows in the book is that by at least 1975, so 14 years before he's banned from baseball, 14 years before his problems become a national scandal, there are people in the Reds clubhouse, including Johnny Bench, apparently, who are worried about Pete Rose. So his gambling is, you know, is sort of an open secret. By 75, 76, 77, 78, it is known. And so, you know, when you start to look at it in that way, you realize that, you know, this story that I'm telling you, this rise and this fall, isn't even a clean rise and a clean fall. Even while he's rising, he is making decisions in the shadows, decisions off the field, choices off the field that are sending him down a path that leads him to his inevitable fall.
Go ahead, Nate. Yeah, well, that takes care of my Pete Rose questions.
Awesome. Well, just a couple quick ones here. Your background as a journalist is apparent. It's obvious all throughout this book. Were you inspired by any particular authors or journalists to get your career started, or as it specifically relates to this book?
Yeah. I mean, inspired, of course, and mentored by many, too many to mention here, but I will mention one. And he is no longer with us. He was a journalist who became a historian and an author by the name of David Halberstam. And, you know, anyone who's interested in great baseball books, I would urge you to pick up the ones that David Halberstam wrote. He was a reporter for the Nashville Tennessean and then the New York Times, who, you know, starting in the 1970s and then into the 1980s, you know, became a prolific author. And, you know, he wrote some of my favorite sports books of all time, including October 1964, which is, you know, ostensibly a story of the 1964 World Series, but really is a story of America changing. It's the 1964 World Series will feature St. Louis Cardinals, which is a young, diverse, Black and Latino team primarily, versus the old school white, primarily white New York Yankees. And in telling the story of that World Series, he's really telling a story of America and how we're changing. And so, you know, I was long ago inspired by David Halberstam's reporting, his writing, and you know, it's something I've, you know, long tried to even emulate in the smallest ways.
You certainly picked a good one there. You've written other books, one of which is about high school basketball in Kentucky, and that's pretty close to home for a lot of our audience. Can you give us a second and describe Outside Shot for those that are just now hearing about it for the first time?
Yeah, so you know, in 2010, I came back to Cincinnati and Kentucky and embedded myself with Scott County High School in Georgetown. And Scott County it was at the time a rural, you know, powerhouse basketball team, and I had all access to Scott County High School for the year to tell the story of the power and the meaning of basketball in Kentucky. Through one team. And, you know, we as sports fans all know the movie Hoosiers, you know, where, you know, there's one state title and little towns are going to play the big cities, et cetera. But, you know, Indiana as a state long ago did away with single class basketball. And it's, you know, Kentucky that's a holdout now. Mm-hmm. Every year in Kentucky, only 16 high school teams make the state tournament, one from each region. You know, so it's little schools playing big schools, private schools playing rural public schools. And I wanted to capture the power and the meaning of basketball in Kentucky by, you know, telling that story. And so, you know, I got all access to Scott County, and that's how I wrote Outside Shot. And you know, anyone who is from Kentucky will know that Billy Hicks was the coach of that team, the all-time winningest coach in Kentucky basketball history, one of the all-time winningest coaches in America, who sadly died all too young just last year.
One more from me. What's your favorite book of all time?
Wow. That is so hard. It's so hard, Nate.
Well, then we can get you back on for a second episode sometime. Give you some time to think about that.
Well, I don't want to skirt the question. I mean, there's just so many and so many different stories. I mentioned October 1964. That is, I think, an all-time great sports book. I love Seabiscuit by Laura Hillenbrand, A Civil Action by Jonathan Haar, a story of environmental activism in Massachusetts in the 1980s. Just those just off the top of my head, but there are just so many. I mean, my walls behind me, as you can see here, are filled with the books that I love. It'd be so impossible to choose just one.
I see many good ones that I've read as well. Hey, tell our listeners, our viewers, where the best places are to buy Charlie Hustle.
Well, you can get Charlie Hustle wherever they buy, wherever they sell books. So wherever they sell books, wherever you like to get books, that's where you can get Charlie Hustle. It's in Kindle, digital books, audio books. If you do want a signed copy, you know, I know Joseph Beth in Cincinnati has many signed copies there. You can also order signed copies through if you want something personalized, say for your father, for Father's Day. You can order them through my local bookstore here in New Hampshire. It's called Water Street Books. You can order it here online. Just note in the sales form, you know, how you want it inscribed or to whom you want it inscribed, and they will ship it to you. Lots of different ways to get the book.
Well, I'm going to pay you a compliment because I felt that David Howardstein was also a great writer. Charlie Hustle is a smoother read for me than October 1964. So I really wanted you to know that I really appreciated the book. And we just loved it so much. It was so, when Nate told me we had this opportunity to talk to you, I was really excited. So thanks so much, Keith, for being here. Nate, let's go ahead and tell the folks what we've got going on at the Riverfront right now.
As always, we've got our regular Red Show coming up on Thursday. Tim and Ben doing great things at Late Night Red. Check out our Bingo Show, Welcome to the Jungle. And as always, Seth, holding it down with some fantastic interviews. And this was a real treat, Keith. Thank you so much for coming on and giving us a few minutes of your time. And I think I speak for all Reds fans when I say thank you for the time and effort that you spent putting this book together. It was an incredible read. It opened my eyes to an era of Reds baseball that I thought I knew something about. And it turns out I knew very little. It was fantastic. And I can't recommend it highly.
Thank you, guys. It was such a pleasure to talk to you. And thanks so much for having me. It was my pleasure to be here.
All right, Keith. Thanks so much.